that what seemed like a very good conversation. We've got work to do. Open the Senate Revenue Committee for April 6th. We're going to start with a public hearing on SDR 25, which is Senator Mona Sanderson's bill with a constituent. So we'll do that public hearing, and then we'll get right into do 899, 845, and then finish with Senate Bill 896 and see if that bill is ready to go. Open a public hearing on SJR, Senate Joint Resolution 25. Mary, and then we'll go to the senator.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Me?
I think so.
Mary?
Yes.
Mary.
She's not Mary.
SJR 25 proposes an amendment to the Oregon Constitution that will enable a taxing district to propose and voters to adopt a rate limit on property taxes that is less than the district's permanent rate limit. Proposes that voters will decide the duration of the rate limit, which can remain in effect for a period of up to 15 years. Requires that voters approve the proposal at a special election held throughout this state on the same date as the next primary election. The background on this is just something I had picked up when I called to try to find out what was behind it. And what I was told was that, in particular, at one point in time, Gresham City Council proposed contracting with a special fire district outside its area to provide services for its residents, as opposed to doing so with its own, maybe, public services within the city. And it would have enabled fire districts to sort of regionalize their services, which might have been cost effective for the fire district. However, Gresham voters, I was told, disapproved the proposal because they felt the fire district's maximum permanent rate limit was too high. And currently, there's no legislation that allows the taxing district to lower its permanent rate. Hence, this proposal was explained. This is how the need for this proposal was explained to me.
Thank you. Good morning, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Deckard, Mr. Chair, and the honorable committee members. Thank you for hearing this and allowing us to come here. I want to put this a little bit in context first, and then I would like Dr. Mike McKeel, who's sitting next to me, who really was the one that wanted to bring this piece of legislation forward. This actually deals, we have a small fire district, it's Fire District 10, and it takes care of East Multnomah County and outlying areas. And then we have a fire district in the city of Gresham, and basically the city of Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview contract with the city of Gresham for fire services. And the concept, the fire district, because the city was having has been having for a number of years now less and less money, therefore there's less and less money going to our firefighters. And so the concept came out that let us merge with and have the do away with basically the city of Gresham's fire district and merge with the Fire District 10. And so that's what the ballot measure was for. And to me it makes sense to regionalize firefighters in an area. It just makes economic sense. Plus it helps especially those areas in the rural areas. We're always talking about the problems between the rural and the urban, and here is a situation where the rural areas are really having a tough time coming up with fire safety in their districts. But the upshot is that they felt that the and I'm going to let Dr. McKeel actually explain this, that the city of Gresham would, if they turned over their fire fighting services to this new district, they would still keep their same level of taxation to the citizens, and that just didn't seem quite right, and everyone doesn't trust government, and so they would say they definitely wouldn't lower their tax rate and keep it, and yet then we'd be paying for Fire District 10 and then also the city. So that sort of gives you the context of it, I think, and I would like Dr. McKeel to continue why he feels this is at least a good bill for discussion. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Dr. McKeel.
Thank you, Senator Deckard and the members of the committee. I feel pleased to be able to come here and explain this kind of a odd situation to you, but and it probably seems odd to you that a Democrat like me is there asking for a tax reduction. So
no,
I'll put that in context. this was a very complicated issue, but I think it has statewide implications in the sense that there are many small districts and small cities that could save money to their citizens by merging services. In doing so, in particular in our situation, it wasn't that we were merging services. The city of Gresham has probably the lowest tax rate in the state of Oregon for a city its size, the fourth largest city, and it's got a tax rate of about $360, which compares to Portland, which is approaching $9 a thousand. Nice. For them to be able to fund a police department and a fire department for themselves is asking a lot. For them to provide fire service as they do now to four other jurisdictions on a contract basis is just gone beyond the bounds. And I explained to Lori when I came in here two Saturdays ago in the Gresham Outlook, because our issue failed, the city of Gresham is proposing to close five city parks, put chain link fences around them, and let them go to seed to pay for their fire service. What our issue was is that we have a tax rate in Fire District 10, which used to be the largest fire district west of the Rocky Mountains until all these annexations kind of diminished its taxing area, we have a tax rate of $2.86. Gresham has a tax rate of $3.60. Had we merged those districts and then in subsequent votes taken Fairview, Wood Village, and Troutdale into that district, we could have probably gotten by on a $2.10 to $2.20 tax rate, which is 10 to 20 to 40 cents under all the surrounding districts with a fully professional fire department and advanced life support in every truck. Because we couldn't lower the constitutional tax rates of those cities, both those tax rates, in particular the city of Gresham, would have applied, $2.86 to Gresham for fire and $3.60 to Gresham for their general fund budget. Combined, it brought their tax rate from $3.60 to over $6 a thousand. We didn't need it. They didn't need it, but there was nothing they could do. So the opponents of the merger argued that we had the authority to tax it, even though we promised to not exercise that authority. And I think that's what caused the election not to. It passed in District 10, but it did not pass in Gresham. Required both districts to do it. So now our five cities, which is really four cities in the East Multnomah County rural area, are faced with contracting with Gresham, who has diminishing resources and is looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of $5 million shortfalls each year. They're a sick jurisdiction, and they're responsible for five other jurisdictions' fire and emergency services. And this is one where actually people who have sudden illness or injury, you know, could possibly have a very consequential outcome to those things, because some of the small cities are now proposed to have community college students man fire trucks with no advanced life support. And if you look at just one example, if you don't have advanced life support on a truck, those people that come can't give clot buster drugs for strokes. It's the difference between maybe 3 days in the hospital or $300,000 in bankruptcy to some people who suffer a sudden stroke. So I think all over the state there are small police departments, small fire departments that could go together and merge and save money to their citizens. But the merger, if it's a combination of both their full tax rates, is going to be just doesn't make sense, and I don't think it's going to be supported by the voters, and the outcome is going to be that the service is going to diminish as each one can't handle the whole load on their own. So that's why we're proposing this, but I think the proposal needs to be done for certain situations, not just that, you know, three or four people get a petition together to lower permanent tax rates. I think that's the opposition to this bill you might hear and probably will. It should be done for circumstances such as ours where a merger is something that's effective for the taxpayers and for the citizens and their service, and that it shouldn't just be that any day in the spring somebody can get a petition together and lower somebody's permanent tax rate. But I think there ought to be a mechanism in the state constitution to lower tax rates to a level that is appropriate to the service, yet still gives cities the ability to function, you know, under the Measure 5 and 50 as it was intended. So I'd be willing to answer any questions you might have, and I prepared a little one-page document on our situation. But like I say, an example, Fairview, Troutdale, and Gresham have three police departments, three fire chiefs, all the training for each of those departments. It would probably make sense to even merge those together because you wouldn't know when you went from one city to the next. And I think those small little districts like that, whether it's fire, police, or other services, you know, really ought not to exist when it could be done more efficiently and effectively for citizens with a lower tax rate.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. McKeon, we just need to get your name for the record.
I'm Michael McKeel, and you need my address.
Just in Gresham, Oregon.
Yeah, Gresham, Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. And if you could pass that one pager out, if you get it to Paul or to Barbara. We actually have a similar situation in Washington County where Senator Starr and I are looking at the same issue of many, many policing jurisdictions, small and medium-sized and large, and whether there's an opportunity to merge. And so this is an issue that we've been discussing just recently. Questions for Dr. McHale? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for the care. Close the public. Anyone else on SJR 25? Close the public hearing on SJR 25 and open a work session on Senate Bill 899. Committee, you remember this bill. It's the one that Washington County, and Dennis, if you want to come up, if you're the maker of the amendments. It's the issue of Washington County bringing us. They didn't want to be a part of this joint tax commission that reviewed budgets, and we didn't want Washington County, but then talked about as do we want this state statute on the books at all. And so we have three amendments before us, and Dennis, do you want to talk about those three?
Yeah, good morning. Dennis Mulvihill, Washington County. Let me go through and say just quickly which each one of them do, and then I'll bring you back to the one that I thought that the committee had asked for. Actually, there is four sets. There was a dash one. And that allows the effect of that one is that Washington County or any county that reaches 500,000 in population may create a tax supervising and conservation commission. The dash two is the one that the committee seemed to be interested in. That repeals the TSCC totally so that nobody would have one that wouldn't actually exist anymore.
Okay, so Dennis, let's just make sure we get this straight. So the dash two just repeals the statute requiring Multnomah County to have a tax supervisory commission.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
The dash one
allows Washington County or any other county that achieves 500,000 in population may create a commission.
Okay.
Dash three It abolishes the commission, and but allows it to be created with a vote, a popular vote at the county level. And that isn't exactly what we were looking for there, but that's what I believe it says. And then in dash 4 is that if you're 500,000 in population before July 1 of 05, you may create a commission with a vote. Again, I think that the what the committee had said they were interested in was the dash 2s, I think. And what Washington County actually had wanted was the dash 1s in the beginning. But that was the, I think that's what this process is about, to discover other opportunities, I guess.
Mary.
I just wanted to clarify that as I read through the amendments, I think that there's a distinction that might have been sort of glossed over, and that's that with one and two, amendment one and two, you're talking about current law. Well, let's go back. Current law says that a tax supervising and conservation commission has to be created if a population exceeds 500,000 as of the latest decennial census, which would be the next decennial census. Washington County would then be over the 500,000. Okay, so a dash 4 amendment, or all the dash 3 and 4 amendments, change that requirement from being population as of the latest decennial census being over 500,000 and says as of July 1, 2005. So it's a slight difference. One in four, for example, give the option amendments. One in four, for example, give each county the ability to create a TSCC. But in the first amendment, you'd only be required to do that, or have the option of doing that, so to speak, after the next decennial census that reveals that you're over 500,000 in population. The dash 4 amendment will say you have that option to consider by vote if you want one after you achieve a population of 500,000 as of July 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
So that's, committee, that is exactly why I'm interested in the dash 2s, which just make it clean for the state that we don't tell counties they should have these tax supervising and conservation commissions. I think the cost is, what, $280,000?
Mm-hmm.
Multnomah County, but let's hear from the county and whoever wants to represent the county on that one. And Lynn, do you want to come up and whoever else want to get ready to represent the other side of this?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Before we take the testimony, I was going to ask staff, based on what Dennis has laid out, is the difference between the dash 3s and the dash 4 is there's the population requirement on the dash 4 to the dash 3.
I wrote notes very quickly that said dash 3 abolishes the Multnomah County, allows any county. Are you saying 3 and 4 or 2 and 4?
3 and 4.
3 abolishes the Multnomah County tax supervising commission, but allows any county with a population of 500,000 as of July 1 to create a TSCC. Dash 4 gives any jurisdiction, any county with a population of 500,000 over as of July 1, the option, so to speak.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning.
Morning, Chair Deckert, members of the Senate Revenue Committee. Stephanie Soden here for Multnomah County. And per the Chair's request, we are submitting a letter signed by our Board of Commissioners in response to the public hearing you held on Senate Bill 899 and the proposed amendments. Today I have with me our Chief Financial Officer, Dave Boyer, to go over the county's position on this bill and the amendments.
Senator Deckert, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave Boyer, and I'm the Chief Financial Officer for Multnomah County. And on behalf of the Board of Commissioners, I'm here to support Senate Bill 899 relating to making it voluntary for the counties, including Multnomah County, to use a tax supervising conservation commission. If you elect to eliminate TSCC altogether, we would also support that. Multnomah County General Fund is approximately $300 million, and we are facing a budget cut of about $15 million for 2006 and are looking at another $30 million in cuts for 2007. The county's income taxes, three-year income taxes, are expiring, so we are looking at cutting $30 million out of our budget for fiscal 2007. As stated in the letter, you'll see that from our Board of County Commissioners, Multnomah County is required by ORS 294 to provide $280,000 in funding to fund a TSCC. In addition to the $280,000, we also fund about $75,000 in housing and other support costs that are included in the county's budget. The county has just gone through a lengthy priority-based budgeting process, and our board has identified many programs and services that they feel are of higher priority than TSCC. Just to illustrate, $280,000 could pay for 6 public health nurses, 5 deputy district attorneys, or 5 juvenile counselors. These are just a few examples. There are many more of what $280,000 could buy. The county charter that became effective January 1st, 1967, requires the county to have a citizen involvement committee to ensure that citizens have access to our board and other elected officials. The county also uses a citizen budget advisory committee to review and make recommendations as we go through our budget deliberations each year. In addition, the county holds many public hearings on our budget as we go through, so we do have the public involvement to scrutinize our budget. And also after that, we have CPAs that actually audit our financial records and our budget as we do our fiscal year-end closing and follow the audit requirements and other ORS requirements according to public finance. In closing, Multnomah County supports your actions to either make it voluntary or eliminate TSCC altogether. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you very much. Questions for the panel from Multnomah County? So what Lynn might say, who follows you, is that their function, obviously, is to kind of be a watchdog and to look at Multnomah County, even though it's out of your budget, but also all the other jurisdictions, and there's many of them, special districts and others. And so that $280,000 that you expend is also money that they save by finding efficiencies and finding areas. And I guess that would be my question to you is, have you found that to be the case where they've been able to find efficiencies and help the county actually save money? So just like a good audit program, sometimes you have to invest a little to save more.
Senator Deckard, Chair, they have not located Tax Supervising Conservation Commission is not really geared to find the efficiencies. We have an internal auditor that is elected that actually does performance audits and really finds the efficiencies for us. So the, I will say Tax Supervising does find errors but that we have made. But again, these errors would have been discovered in next year's or through our audit. We feel as we have gone through, our auditors would have found the major errors. And, I mean, they do locate things that we have done wrong, but again, other counties throughout the state of our, you know, not our size, but getting close to our size, go through the same thing and are not required to have a TSCC. So that I can't say that they found any efficiencies for Multnomah County.
So you haven't found one example where the TSCC has come in and said, county, you could do this, you could do that, and it would save you $75,000.
Not in my term there.
And how long has your term been?
25 years.
Okay. Thank you very much. Ms. McNamara.
Good morning. Deckard, members of the committee, my name is Lynn McNamara. I serve as a volunteer commissioner on the Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission of Multnomah County. I've been a commissioner since 2001, and I am the chair of the commission this year. On behalf of my fellow commissioners, we don't see TSCC as a redundant service There are 37 taxing districts in Multnomah County that we work with, and the combined budgets of these taxing districts is over $7 billion. So we're talking about a very broad oversight role for the commission. And the staff, of course, you know, we take a role, obviously, in looking at all of these budgets and providing comprehensive information about them for the citizens of the county. I think for the average citizen, if you were to go and to try to delve into not only the budget of Multnomah County and the city of Portland, but Metro, the port, Portland Public Schools, the other school districts in the county, there is just a huge amount of information that the average citizen would have trouble getting through. And I'm going to submit for the record, and the members will have a chance to take a look at the annual report that the commission prepares that consolidates all of this information and puts it in a friendly form for the taxpayer. I think we're actually surveying our districts right now to really get a gauge of their support for the commission, and if you were to go in a different direction, and if funding is the issue, to look at perhaps alternatives to funding other than just by the county. But we're gauging the support not only for what we do for the staff, but how they perceive our role with regard to being a filter for the taxpayer, that the taxpayer has one place to come to ask for information. We think that the commission provides accountability and, as you said, potentially a watchdog for the taxpayer. We have a pretty wide role with regard to local budget law, and that is a real specific area of the statute. The issues that TSCC has looked at, and they were documented in a letter that I provided to each of the committee members yesterday, really looks at, for example, areas where taxes might be over-levied, and that is corrected before those taxes are levied and has ultimately cut back over the past 10 years about $6 million that would have been levied in a correct year. It would have been corrected the next year, as Dave Boyer pointed out, but in the meantime, the taxpayers did not have to incur that unwarranted cost. So in summary, we think Multnomah County is in a somewhat unique position of having so many disparate and distinct taxing districts and such a wide variety of budget information that has to be gathered. We think that we provide a valuable service. We would not favor eliminating the Multnomah County TSCC. We certainly would be willing to look at different ways of funding it, although, for example, assessment and taxation is one of those areas that the county carries out and funds, but other districts in the county certainly benefit from that. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Lynn. And Senator Brzezinski.
Based on the letter we've received from the commissioners from Multnomah County, I mean, it looks like if given the opportunity, they would basically vote to not support keeping the TSCC. And so that would undercut a significant amount of the funding. I mean, what proposal would you have for us to keep and consider that would keep it in place? It seems to me that what we're doing is we're maintain the state oversight. And I guess the only thing, and I apologize, I had to step out, if you went over this in your testimony, why the districts or the commissions were actually even established in the first place, and why in today's world do we need to have that continue to have that level. And I understand for the smaller districts, given the oversight and all that, I did know that. But it just seems to me that there's other checks and balances in the process now that will accommodate those needs.
Chair Deckard, Senator Brzezinski, to get to your last question, first, I think that Multnomah County is unique in that there are 37 taxing districts, there are school districts. We were out at the Sobey Island Fire District the other night, very small districts, and, of course, Metro, TriMet, the Port, City of Portland, Multnomah County are very large districts. And our role really is to look at all of them as a whole and to give the Multnomah County taxpayer comparative and comprehensive information about those districts, their budgets, their tax levies, and to make sure that it is done correctly. I look at my tax bill as a Multnomah County resident, there are an awful lot of taxing districts on that that I contribute to. And to have to know that there is that kind of oversight and that kind of single point of presence for the taxpayer, we believe is important. We would certainly, we understand the county's point of view in terms of the, and every taxing district's point of view in terms of the limited funding that is available, the revenue situations are getting worse and the demands for service are more. No one would argue with that. It would not be an unreasonable thing to certainly go to the other taxing districts and say, would you be willing to pay a portion of this on some kind of prorated basis if it were to continue?
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up.
Please.
If we actually adopted one that was the May permissive, I would assume at that point you're going to have, based on the county commissioner's letters, their position is going to be they don't want to play in this arena anymore. They think they have enough oversight mm-hmm. themselves. So it would seem like they would take whatever steps to disassemble the commission. And then I guess the question at that point would be, how would this become, I guess, before the voters? I mean, it would seem like there would have to be some type of initiative that was thrown out there, the support for it. And I guess what I haven't seen today, Mr. Chair, or other times, is any of these other taxing districts that you've mentioned, the other 36, that have come in here in support of maintaining the TSCC. And if you covered that, I apologize, but I just have not seen anything come into my office regarding their desire to keep status quo.
Mr. Chair, Senator Przanski, we have just begun to do a survey of our taxing districts and to gauge their level of support for continuing TSCC. I apologize that the timing is not such that we can bring you comprehensive information about where they all stand and whether they would be willing to fund the program going forward.
And please excuse his tie. He's from Eugene, and he's trying to be academic.
Senator Duck wearing this. But I went to a land-grant school, so there's actually a connection there somewhere. It's just from what we heard before, and I don't think you were here at the first hearing. It's pretty convincing and appealing, I guess, from my perspective. I think from what I've heard the other members say, that it appears that maybe this day and time, it's time for a change in a means of settling or saving on the front end. And I guess I have some difficulty right now not hearing any convincing information as to why the proposals that are before us, something should move forward. And I guess I know this is a work session. I assume that we have the amendments before us, that we may be taking action today. And if we do take action today, what I would suggest is that you continue very quickly in getting whatever information you get back from those districts and present it when it goes to the other chamber.
Thank you, Senator.
The threshold question for me is why the state should tell any county they have to have these commissions. If the counties want to, then that's their own prerogative. But for me, it's why the state ought to prescribe that. Senator Stark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned, and I've heard from taxpayers, that you provide a centralized service for taxpayer information so that they may more readily understand the information they get on their tax statement or ballot or whatever. Seems to me that for the many taxing districts that you represent, that is a vital service that any citizen who maybe has a dozen different taxing districts represented has real difficulty in going to them individually and finding information. Is that not what I heard from you?
Chair Decker, Senator Starr, yes it is.
Mr. Chair, I would appreciate having Jason come up and talk to us as a representative of taxpayers and tell us what they think of the idea of disbanding this commission.
We are going to do that in half a moment. Anyone, any other questions for Lynn? Thank you, Lynn. I know this has not been a fun process for you, and appreciate how nice you've been throughout it.
Thank you.
Mr. Jason Williams, his first appearance before the Senate Revenue Committee. Hopefully he's appreciative of our work in terms of saving taxpayer money on this. Good morning.
Well, actually I am, and I've been very proud of the work, especially with the tax amnesty issue that you've been working on, and I've been praising that. Anyways, for the record, my name is Jason Williams, Taxpayer Association of Oregon. Sorry, just came in the door. My car kind of ran over an embankment there, so I was having to run around this morning. But I just kind of wanted to put in a word. I know that there's some talk about changes. How's the car doing? Well, it's in the shop. Thank goodness for car rentals. Yeah. Well, you know how sometimes you go to a parking lot, and you know, and if there's no car in front of you, when you get back into your car, you move forward, you know, into the empty space. Well, I didn't know that there's a little concrete slab there in front of my car, but it's how it goes. But anyways, I only wanted to spend a few quick seconds on this. Our experience with the Tax Supervising Commission has just been outstanding there in the Multnomah County, and it is one of the best performing government entities I've come across out of all my time working with county and local and state government. There is right now a problem with even understanding a lot of these budgets when governments grow to be a certain size, and we see this in Portland where a person has a problem with the permit office, and then the ombudsman tries to get in there and talk to the permit office, and not even they can talk to each other. But suddenly, one thing that we have to say is with the Tax Supervising Commission is they have been able to bridge the gap and be able to provide a very great document about budgets. It's been one of the best access and tools that the public has and that the media uses to understanding, boy, what are all these budgets about, putting it in a form people can understand. And, I mean, it's just outstanding. And I would really hope that as governments become larger and they do meet that threshold that they would adopt these, because this is really, this book and what they produce is really the gold standard for how public access and transparency in government should be. And because they do end up saving taxpayer dollars, that, you know, this should be one of the programs we should save, because they save money. And when I think about some of the great reports that news articles and some of the great reports by some, you know, independent think tank organizations that have come out of Multnomah County and Portland, it's because of this book. It's because of the work that they have done. So a lot of the things where we discover where money is being used here or money should be here, and a lot of these great reports have come because of that report. So I would just really advocate, this is really one of the best friends for both government and taxpayers that I can really point to in the state. So I really hope that you guys would not touch it at all.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Williams? So the dilemma for us is just, should the state tell counties you have to have this commission? And that's kind of what we're circling around here is, perhaps they're a good idea or a bad idea for counties, but should we? I mean, we're looking at taking Washington County out of the requirement, that's what's before us is the whole question of whether the state would tell Multnomah County you must do this.
Chair Deckard, members of the committee, and I do understand the implications on local control on that, but I would just have to say, because this seems to perform so superbly in terms of transparency, and those local governments, especially in, you know, Multnomah County, Portland, have had such a poor record of dealing with the Oregonian and dealing with other organizations that want to get this information. I can't help but say that, look, it has an A rating from us, and just this is really worth the. And because they also, if they end up saving more than their actual budget is, then I definitely think it's worth it. So.
Great. Thank you. Senator Prezansky.
Knowing what we have before us, and since we only have one in the state right now that meets the criteria, understanding that Washington County will be there relatively soon. The threshold of $500,000, do you know why, or any perspective as to why we have that? And also, is it propose or believe that because the larger the population of a county, the more special districts you have. And that's why I'm just trying to get the philosophy of why the state, when it originally adopted this requirement, why they chose those numbers. And has your organization done any review as to the philosophy that was brought forward during that time?
Chair, members of the committee, I haven't done any research on why they, you know, way back 100 or 75 years ago, they picked that particular number or whatever. But I just know that to me that seems to be kind of a spirit that if a government gets to be so large, then you take this extra step. I can understand the reasoning behind that argument, that, and we all see it, that the bigger budgets become and the more governments and the more taxing districts, it can get... it becomes more difficult to comprehend. And, you know, my complaint, you know, I mean, I look at the state budget, the governor's budget book, which is our primary access to the budget. And even though the budget may grow by $5 billion, the book stays the same. And we've got seven pages of text to explain to us what the Department of Transportation does with almost $3 billion. And so it becomes harder, and I think just by the nature of bureaucracy, just the nature of it, it grows to be very untransparent and sets up natural barriers to the public. So the idea that you would set a benchmark by saying, hey, if you get to be this many people, it kicks this trigger in, seems to be a very rational argument on our part.
Senator George.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Jason, I agree with your analysis as to where we are in relationship to Multnomah County, and I would really support the idea that we had a tax supervising and conservation commission, you know, to go over and get this all this information for us in some sort of order where even we could understand it. But the idea of us not doing that but mandating a local, you know, seems to me pretty offensive. And could you respond to that?
Senator George, Chair, members of the committee, I think I'd address that just a few minutes ago with Deckard's original question to me. It's that looking at what we've seen on how this commission has performed so well, and looking on how oftentimes the local governments are the larger of the governments are the ones that are giving the newspapers the hardest time and the taxpayers the hardest time in understanding their budgets. You know, for me, it's like, you know, throwing out a life-saving device and saying, hey, if this works, let's do that. If someone wants to come up with another thing that can, you know, keep it a pure local control, fine. But I know that if we get rid of this commission, it's going to be harder for both the media and for taxpayers to be able to have transparency and access to all of these 35 budgets that are underneath this document.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Now, Paul, the Taxpayers Association has been praising our work, so could you check our work plan and review? Committee, we're in work session. We have had a couple hearings on this issue. The Dash 2s repealed the requirement. Mary, do you want to walk through the amendments just real quickly?
Very quickly, what I had was that the Dash 1 gave the county an option of creating a TSCC when it's 500,000 population measured by the next decennial census. Basically, it says the population is over 500,000, but it's as of the next decennial census, or the latest one. 2, would abolish the MCTS and repeals the provisions that say it's even required. 3, abolishes the MCTSC and allows any county with a population of 500,000 or more as of July 1, 2005 to create a TSCC with voter approval. And option 4 simply gives the option to population of 500,000 or more as of July 1, 2005 this ability to create a TSCC. It says nothing about the MCTS.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
what I'm hearing is that dash threes and dash fours are going to take a snapshot of the population as of July of this year.
At which point Washington County will exceed that, probably will exceed that amount.
Yeah.
I think in the notes originally I said, based on historical annualized 3% growth rate, Washington County's population will approach 501,000 mm-hmm. as of July 2014.
Okay, so under that scenario, there'd only be two counties, the way I hear the way the amendments are written, that would be obligated to have, or potentially could have, these commissions, the TSCCs, because if another county in 5 years from now reaches that threshold of 500,000, since they weren't at 500,000 in July of 05, then they're not going to be in the same rule, at least the way I'm understanding how these amendments are set. That doesn't say anything prospective as to a change in the population. So I think my biggest concern is making sure that we have something that has continuity for the state, for all of the counties, and we don't basically set up where only potentially two counties are impacted by this legislation. So I'm not sure if that was the intent of those amendments or not.
I'm not sure if they got them. I mean, when Dennis presented them, I think the dash threes and the dash fours, the concern I have, and I think the testimony was helpful, is that this is, a 1917 statute that requires counties to have these commissions. And I just don't, maybe Senator George's point is, to me, the right one. I just don't know that it's the state's role to tell counties you must go out and create the, I mean, I don't know what the dynamics were in 1917, but it's just, to me, it's questionable whether the state should be telling counties. Now, if they want to do it, they would have every right and ability to actually go out and do it.
And I think that's the part about being permissive. And the question is, do we abolish them all and then let them go back out and do it, or do we allow potentially Multnomah County? My reading of the letter from the commissioners, and I would assume that they are the bigger player in this whole scenario. It looks like their intent is they're going to be probably moving to not do it. But that's something to be decided. It would seem to me that from a state perspective, we probably don't want to absolutely mandate it, but we shouldn't. We need to make certain that there's a mechanism for those who want it can do it, and since there's only one county at this point, just making sure that whatever vote we take today that's going to go forward with whatever piece of legislation doesn't put them in a more awkward position to carry out whatever their wishes are to maintain it or to abolish it.
Mm-hmm. They could maintain it if they choose.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Stark.
Well, it seemed like the Dash 4 Amendment accomplishes that purpose, makes it permissive that any county, with the approval of majority of the governing body voting on the question, may establish a commission. Any county that reaches on or after July 1st, population of 500,000, has the option then of voting on the issue, whether it's the county commission that does the voting initially, people refer it for a vote of the people, or it would be up to the county then. I think that's the better way to leave it.
Okay, so I hear one for the dash fours. Okay, Mary, let's do the, so review the dash fours for the committee just so that we're all on the same page. Dennis, do you want to do the dash four? Do you want to? You drafted the dash four. Yes, Senator George.
Where he's coming up. I served for 6 years on a county budget committee and chaired it for 2 years. And I can tell you that it wasn't 1917. Great detail, small county. Great detail of the budget, beautiful graphing as to what was going on. Details such as how many traps should the trapper have. I mean, it's amazing the amount of detail that was presented to that committee. May I also say much more detail than we get in budgeting here. And I really appreciate that. And the conclusion that I came through to after serving on that was, I think they probably know what's best to do, and I'm really curious as to why we would want to continue this. It's an option that they can do. They could add, you know, the members of this supervising unit can could be moved over and actually added to the budget committee. There's nothing to stop them from doing that.
But if I could respond, what I heard Ms. Williams say, it's basically having one central point for all of the information from the taxing districts, in this case 37, to be accumulated and basically available, instead of having what I would assume the voters, and his example, he was using the media to actually go, I guess, to each and every one and then having difficulty in getting that information. Of course, there's means of making that happen. So that's, you know, that's fine. I do appreciate Senator Starr pointing out, because when you do look at the dashboard, lines 12, 13, it does say not only on that date, but also or after. And so there would be the consistency that I would be looking for if we were going to move one an amendment, that we're not basically setting up legislation that would only impact two counties, and that the others, as they come to that level, would be able to do it.
Yeah. You know, I mean, the dash twos, they'd affect everyone. It would just be the state no longer requires this. It's just it's up to the counties, Lane County.
And without any type of poverty thresholds of population or number of taxing districts or anything like that is what the dash twos would do.
Yeah, it just says the state is out of this game of telling counties what to do and not to do. Okay, so let's come to a decision. Dennis, yes, sir.
My reading of the dash four amendments is that you would allow everybody except Multnomah County to not have one. It would be permissive for everyone but them. So what it would, it's another way of getting at what Washington County was looking for, but it doesn't get at what I thought the committee was going towards. So
the dash four, that's why I asked, because I'd heard three different renditions. So the dash fours allow all the other counties out, but says Multnomah counties will still exist.
Mr. Chairman, that's the practical effect of it, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mary, and, well, Senator Starr and then Mary. Senator Starr.
As I read the dash twos, it requires the TSCC to deliver all records to the county and abolishes the commission. Am I reading that wrong?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator George.
I think that would be a decision that they would make based upon, as we heard earlier, talking about contracting for fire services and stuff like this. They're going to make that decision based upon what they perceive as the interest of Multnomah County.
Okay.
And if they decide to leave the records where they are and continue the process, then that's probably what they would do. I don't think we're requiring them to do that. Correct me if I'm wrong, Mr.
Chair.
Yeah, Senator Krasanski.
I'm going to ask the chair. I know the chair wants to take action on this today. I'm going to ask the chair to consider this, that we can actually carry this over till tomorrow.
We can't, though. Is it up? Do we have it scheduled?
All we have to do is you have to do is say you carry it over.
Friday.
Well, under the rules, you can carry it over to any day. You just don't quit. You basically keep the work session going. You're just saying it's the next, whatever the next day you want.
You can't adjourn the committee.
If
you adjourn the committee,
then
you have 48
hours.
But we're focused on Friday, so
we bring it back. Okay, so either way, the reality is we're stumbling as to making sure we know what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And I think before we take action, I personally would like to go through and read each of these. So when we make the vote, we know we're making a vote that we don't need to take it to the floor, realize that maybe we need to bring it back to committee and redo it.
I'm fine with that.
It shouldn't take us long to vote it out. We've had enough testimony. Now it's basically making sure we fully appreciate and understand what each of these amendments does. So when we vote, we're informed to the point of where we're ready to move it all the way.
Mm-hmm. We have had these amendments for at least a period of time, but I'm fine if there's any questions. Mary, if you could then prepare something that's just crystal clear on what the dash ones, dash twos, dash threes, and dash fours do, and get them to the committee members. We'll bring this back on Friday, rather than which I'm fine with, but rather than voting on something that there's different stories of what the amendments accomplish.
And Mr. Chair, just for the record, I'm not sure when the chair got wind of the amendments, but mine are dated for the dash twos are 4/5/05, and the dash threes and fours are dated today. And so these are the first times I've seen them.
I got them at 8:15.
Yeah, and so I just think that we're looking at making a pretty significant change here. I appreciate the chair being willing to allow us to make sure we know what each of the amendments have before we vote on them.
Great. Thank you. We'll put this back up for Friday and have asked just people be ready to adopt one of them. Close the work session on Senate Bill 899 and open a work session on Senate Bill 845. Steve, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 845. You had a public hearing on it about a month ago. The bill deals with the unused value of gift cards, and the original bill designated that the unused value of gift cards would become abandoned property after 3 years from the date of purchase or the last transaction. The original bill prohibited issuing cards with expiration dates or having fees attached to those cards. And it excluded prepaid phone cards and prepaid commercial mobile radio services. You have a dash one amendment to the bill that was the result of the work of State Lands in proposing various alternative draft amendments to the interested parties and getting feedback from those, and the dash one was the favored approach, although I'm not sure that it satisfies everybody, at least the opponents to the proposal. The dash one has four parts to it. It expands the definition of gift card to also include that the value shown on the record is from a magnetic strip or microprocessor chip or other means of storage of information. The next change, beginning in line 9 of the dash one amendment, exempts the cards that would be used for charitable purposes or by nonprofit or corporations for fundraising purposes. That was one of the concerns. The third begins on line 14, dealing with gift cards that are redeemable in merchandise only. If there's value left on the gift card, that only 75% of it would have to be turned over to the Division of State Lands as abandoned property. The business would keep the other 25%. The fourth proposal begins in line 17 that deals with the criteria for payment to the Division of State Lands. And you have the three criteria there, that the issuer of the gift knows that the card was purchased in this state, or the issuer has its principal place of business in this state and the record of the purchaser is not known, or three, the issuer has a principal place of business in this state, the records show that the card was purchased in another state, but the laws of the other state would not lay claim to the unused value. So those are the ideas that were incorporated into the dash one based upon the testimony you had at the last hearing.
Great. Thank you, Steve. Well, do y'all want to come up and talk about the dash ones that were prepared, Laurie?
Jeanette
is our non-biased expert on this. And Julie, if you wanna come and argue against them. Oh boy, she's got the orange and black on. It's Oregon State Beaver Day at the Capitol today. Mrs. Swimmer-Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, to the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen with the Oregon Education Association. The Dash 1 amendments are kind of a culmination of our desire to make sure that we were clear on the record and in the statutes about what we meant, not gift certificates, but the gift cards explicitly, as that issue came up in our original hearing, as well as some of the other points as Steve has outlined for you. One of the things that we did with respect to the Education Stakeholders Coalition is that we wanted to make sure that we accommodated some of the concerns that were brought by the other side on this, and I'll bring your attention to lines 14 through 16 of the Dash 1 amendments. And the point about that is for those gift cards that are issued for which, let's say you get a $20 card to Borders and you buy a $15 book, they don't issue $5 in currency. They just retain the value of the card and you have to use it to purchase on another day. We said that in those kinds of policy cases that the reportable amount after 3 years would only be 75% of face value instead of 100% as a way of making a concession to the business community on that piece. So we're trying to be reasonable in our amendments and clarify the issues that emerged. And so I thank you very much for your time, and we hope you can support the amendments.
Okay, and this solves the whole issue of paper certificates.
Yes, sure.
And Jeanette, you're shaking your head also. Good morning.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Jeanette Holman from the Department of State Lands. Yes, actually the paper certificates part is addressed in the new definition of the revised definition of gift card, because we specify that it's an electronic record, which encompasses the plastic magnetic strip type gift card rather than just a paper one that we issue. The 75% issue was raised by AOI, and they referred us to a case in the Tennessee courts, and that's what that case was about. And a number of states have addressed that issue by doing a reduced amount of reporting, stating that in that case the court said that the holder had an interest in the unredeemed part, or in the expectation of a profit and that they would make on a gift card. And to adjust for that, states have reduced the percentage that they have to report, and that seems to be held up in other courts in other states. The constitutionality, there was a constitutional issue raised about whether we could make these effective right away on gift cards. There was some discussion about whether we could bump up so that we could start collecting this money earlier, and I looked into the possibility of doing that, and that it would raise contractual issues and constitutional issues to start collecting before the holders had a chance to change their cards, and because there may be an interference with the contract issue if we did that. So we left the effective date with the normal effective date. This would apply to cards issued after the effective date of the act. Finally, I would add that the U.S. Supreme Court has characterized unclaimed property as not a takings issue, because the state is not holding this property for the benefit of the state. They are acting more in the role of a conservator, and as such they hold it for the person who's rightfully entitled to it, and that has kept these cases out of the takings issue arena. And I guess with that, I just answer any questions you might have.
Great, thank you. Questions for, Senator George.
Let me think of that idea that they're just holding it. Are you telling me there's going to be no transfers from these accounts as they accumulate all these loans?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, we hold them in perpetuity, and because of that, it does not go into the general fund. It does not get used for other government purposes other than the interest that we earn on them, which goes into the Common School Fund. Because we don't actually transfer ownership from the person who's rightfully entitled to the accounts, the courts have held that it's not the state taking anybody's money for a purpose.
Jeanette?
Julie, did this all this good information bring you on board? Or
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis. No, my husband had an easier time converting a U of O graduate to a Beaver fan than you're going to have getting me on this legislation.
That hurts me too.
I know it does, Senator, and I understand that, but that's just the way the ball. He agreed to raise the kids as Catholic, so I had to do something. So
at least for the day.
Well, no, it's pretty good agreement that we have. But anyway, I think our opposition to the legislation remains very strong, and I will walk through again the reasons why. The concession that they did make was in response to the Tennessee court case. It isn't a concession in regards to fairness or applicability of the legislation or how convenient it is to comply with. The role of the Division of State Lands is to put money in the hands of the rightful owner. And our argument is that the rightful owner still may own the gift certificate, the gift card. They still may have it in his or her purse. And by establishing the state imposing an expiration date while forbidding the retailer from imposing their own expiration date, you're already, one, giving the state more authority to take that money, even though it may have never left the rightful owner. And I think unless you actually have the card, it's going to be hard to convince the Division of State Lands that you are indeed the rightful owner. The unclaimed property under this proposal will escheat to the state, and the state, again, as the argument I made a couple weeks ago or months ago, is converting the gift card into cash. Again, most retailers do not afford this convenient to the customer. So, again, the state is authorizing itself to have more authority than the individual customer. The bill remains vague on how the retailer is to report this information, and to me it sounds like a complete nightmare. Now, please keep in mind that, yeah, we have computerized systems and so on and so forth, but this is not a push-the-button issue. Take, for instance, the amendment. The amendment exempts nonprofit organizations, gift cards sold to nonprofit organizations. Our computer systems do not know how to sort who purchased a gift card on behalf of a nonprofit organization. We simply don't do that. So, again, that is another argument. When I talked to the retailers last Friday, on the national retailers on this legislation, they were very clear, and I've had this happen, and I hope you have as well, where you go in with a gift card that may have an expiration date, or you might be 3 years old or 4 years old. The Talbot's one that I brought 4 weeks ago is a perfect example. They want to honor gift certificates and gift cards, and they will. So even if you impose a 3-year mandate expiration date as legislators, they will not probably comply with that. I do not think our association does not think it's good policy to treat gift cards and gift certificates differently. And finally, I think the Division of State Lands has done an excellent job, and they've done a very good job of trying to listen to folks' concerns, but. They're right that gift certificates have not really come up in the Supreme Court in regards to like a taking or a constitutional issue. But there are a variety of Supreme Court cases that rule on the primary and secondary rule of ownership. And although there are no Supreme Court, as I said, there are no Supreme Court cases on gift certificates, there are plenty of Supreme Court cases on unclaimed property. And there are two rules that come into play when determining who the state property escheats to. The primary rule would be the last known address. And simply put, we do not believe the zip code of where it was purchased is the last known address of the holder. The obligor, or the creditor, is the person who holds it, not the person who purchased it or the zip code. That is just creating a fictional address. That's all it is. So if the primary rule can't come into play, then the Supreme Court has said the secondary rule comes into play. And the Supreme Court has said that that's the debtor state of incorporation. And that's a frustration to legislators. And I understand that. But I am not a lawyer. I'm not going to sit on the Supreme Court. And I'm not going to be able to change that. And the reason the Supreme Court has been so solid in these cases is because the last thing they want is states fighting over who has the right to unclaimed property. So these are some of our objections to the legislation, and you can understand, I hope, a little bit better why we're not going to agree to these amendments, and we'll continue to oppose the legislation.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Brandis? Senator George.
Julie, I'm really concerned about that idea that you can't separate out these ones issued for the purpose of fundraiser. But the other issue that I'd like to ask you about is this issue of, when I say it's three, we get to the third year, and let's call it 4 years, and I walk in, I pull out my little magnetic card, and I give it to the person. What's the retailer going to do if, in fact, they've technically transferred that? I mean, is there enough identification, or does it put a retailer in the case of paying the money to two different people?
Mr. Deckert, and Senator George, you're right. Most national retailers who have a great investment into their customer base, they're going to honor it both places. They're going to turn it over to the state, and then they're also going to redeem it. The May Company, Robinson May Company, was on the phone and very vehement about this, that they will honor their customers who come in and ask for the redemption, as would probably Talbot's, Target, any company like that.
Mr. Chairman, a follow-up?
Yeah, please.
Well, then what would keep me from coming to the state and saying, oh, by the way, you know, I think you have some of my money. I have a card here. Because, you know, I haven't surrendered the card. It just technically at the retailer shows that there's zero balance. Is the state going to be able to determine whether or not I've zeroed out the balance?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we would probably honor that gift certificate, and I do not know at this point. Again, I think this is a records-keeping issue, how the state and the retailer are going to true this up.
Jeanette. Mr. Chair, Senator George, maybe I can help a little. Currently, the state, if a holder redeems an unclaimed property sometime after they've reported it to us, they can submit a claim to us, and we send back their money to them. So we get all the time holders' claims, particularly in the case of traveler's checks, where they have paid a traveler's check after it's already been sent to us, and we send the money back to American Express or whoever it is. As long as they, you know, presumably, you know, I think most of these gift cards have a number, and this is where the electronic process, if they send us a list of the gift cards that they have redeemed, that they've already sent in to us, we can send them back the money. We do it all the time now.
Senator Zanski.
Mr. Chair, I'm comfortable with that, but I'm not comfortable with what Ms. Brandis brought up regarding the charitable organizations. I just see a burden now that we have shifted. And I see basically, she said, a nightmare. I don't see how we justify and how we articulate to the retailer that this is one card. I mean, it's almost like you'd have to have two different sets of cards that would be used, one that would be a charitable, one that may be issued to an organization that's going to go out and fundraise. And that, I can see how that could be tracked. But if someone from United Way says we're going to do a major push in capital fundraising for some organization, let's get a whole bunch of these cards for whoever, or from whoever. I don't see that. I mean, I understand the goal here in trying to not impact these charitable organizations, but I don't see that working in the retail scenario that's I'm familiar with what we've heard.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pazanski, I'm not sure how it would work other than if they track, again, electronically, that, you know, this blank bunch of cards were given for charitable purposes, so they don't have to report them. When we get them, we would make no differentiation between whether someone was turning them in as unclaimed because they bought them at a charitable organization, through a charitable organization or not.
If I can follow up, please. This is going to change topics. Julie, can come back to your statement and testimony today regarding that this other split of 25-75 split for the state at the retailer. You may, at least if I heard your testimony, you're saying that it was based on the ruling out of the Tennessee case, it wasn't something as we understand you've got some overhead in dealing with this that wouldn't allow you to keep 25 for processing. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the point we made in our first testimony 4 weeks ago or whenever it was in regards to the Tennessee court saying you have a contract here and you're basically, and I didn't read the full case, but I think the summary was there's contract language and you're taking part of that, you're taking the full value of that contract. And I think in many Supreme Court cases on takings, they've said you can't take the full percentage of the contract. You can only take a portion or not 100% of it. And I think that's what they were addressing. I still think you have a contractual issue because, again, the obligor and the debtor, the obligor is the person who is in, who actually owns or has, you know, possession is 9/10 of the law, the person who has the gift card. It is not the fictional address of where the purchase occurred.
And that's, if I can follow up,
please.
And that's the other part, I guess I want to, because what I heard you say is that there's at this point, a two-part test that the courts have put out. First one is if you know the address, last known, that's where it's going to be. But if not, it reverts on the second prong back to the locale of the business that issued the card.
The state of Mr. Chair, members, the state of incorporation, and that's a frustration that legislators have had across the state, and I understand that because many states are not, many businesses are not incorporated in Oregon. They're incorporated in another state, and that's, again, one of the major arguments why we exempted gift cards out of this type of regulation sessions ago is because it served no purpose because it was going to Delaware.
And that's what I was going to ask, Mr. Chair. I don't know if the relating clause will allow us to become the Delaware of the West Coast, but it seems like that's what we would need to do to meet that test.
Well, how many states have provisions on gift cards?
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, it's in the 30s. I'm not sure exactly how many. Most states have them. Most gift cards were part of the Model Act. I might also add
so
that there
just
is...
Just to stop there, and then I'll let you continue. Okay. So we're in some ways in the minority with the statute that we have. And so some other states, the majority of states, are finding some way to deal with this question. Is that correct? Or
that's
they've grappled through this?
I think most states never took out the gift certificates language that Oregon did in the 90s, and they have continued to collect under the gift cards as a form of gift certificates. Mm-hmm. I might add that there's also a third test for reporting that under those Supreme Court cases, and that's the one on the transaction. The place of transaction is the third part of those tests, and that's the one, that's why the zip code would work. It's not necessarily because that's where the person lives, but it's the place where the transaction took place.
Mr. Chair, just following up on that, I now hear there's three different parts or tests that are applied. Is there a priority of which is applied in which order? Because, I mean, if Ms. Brandis is correct as to the second one being the state of incorporation, how do you get to the third? I mean, automatically, I mean, unless the corporation's defunct and has gone out of business, you're never going to get to the third one.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pazanski, my understanding is that the place of transaction would be the second, but I would have to check that for sure.
I will say it makes more sense to me hearing that there's 30-something states that have it. That would be more than likely. But, again, this is one of those legal issues. I'm just not comfortable on that. But I think the other part that Senator George and myself have expressed, separating out nonprofit use of cards. I mean, I'm here to support where we can to make sure money gets in the common school fund, but I think we need to have that balancing as to what's reasonable and what, you know, what works and what doesn't. And separating out and saying it's for this purpose versus another purpose, it just seems to me that we're setting up a scenario that's just going to be a nightmare. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, some of the work that I did to prepare for today was looking at some of the issues that are going on in Connecticut regarding this, and that's where I got the primary and secondary. Nothing in the testimony that I reviewed for that brought up the third type of challenge. So I don't know what comes first, primary, secondary, or where the transaction occurred. When I gave my, I don't have it in this folder, when I gave my initial testimony, I think I talked about maybe 22 states have exempted gift cards. And I can't remember. I remember we sort of had the philosophical discussion as 22 going up or 22 going down, but I, for some reason, I remember saying that, but that could be wrong, and I don't have it. You might actually have it in your folders there. So the other thing that states have done, and we would not support this. I don't want to imply that, but states have taken a look at what level they want their division of state lands chasing around. I mean, do they want a $5 gift certificate chased around, and do they want to throw that in as into the record keeping, or do they want to be chasing around, you know, the Nordstrom's gift certificate that I never redeemed that has $200 of value in it. And I don't know why I haven't redeemed that. It's in my wallet. I guess you guys keeping me busy this session. So.
Well, there is a Nordstrom's in Salem, I think.
We have a day off in May.
Thank you, Senator. I'll keep that in mind.
Okay, well, let's go to Lori, and then we'll wrap this up because I think we have a constant. Okay, sir, we'll bring you in just a moment.
I'm just looking at my notes, Mr. Chair and committee members, from our hearing, and it said that 23 states exclude gift cards, and Senator Prezanski, I think you made the point then that 27 states do include. So that's those are my notes from our hearing last time in terms of the question that was asked about who has the gift card laws and who doesn't. And I would just make one other point about the issue of nonprofits and the balance. And one of those is that it's been my experience just as an observer of the market that it responds to rather briskly and rapidly changing conditions in order to remain profitable. And if there's a gift card law, as there are in so many states, I would expect that there would be a way to put a tag on that sale if a block of cards are issued for the purpose of nonprofit, and there would be a way to track that. And that's why we were explicit to carve out the certificates, the paper certificates, in deference to small business, in deference to those who don't have a computerized, sophisticated way of doing that data tracking. And so I think we might be thinking it's a bigger issue than it really might be. And finally, with respect to balance on the 75-25, if the full face value is not cashed on a given card after 3 years, note that 25% profit for providing zero merchandise is a pretty good gift to the business community on balance, and I think that is something to consider as you weigh the full implication of this piece of policy. And finally, the issue of this being taken from the cardholder, we see it as a consumer protection issue. I don't know how it ever got down that different pathway, because businesses do come and go. And if they've issued a gift card but subsequently declared bankruptcy, the gift card holder is without any recourse under current law, but under this would actually have the ability to reclaim those dollars through the unclaimed property in the three-year period. So I just remember that in addition to the ability of the stakeholders to get some interest off of the unclaimed property when it's cheated, that there's also the issue of the consumer protection that's inherent in this proposal. And we'd like to leave that with you.
Great. Thank you very, very much. Yes, sir, please come up, and you'll be our last witness for the day. I'll say to the proponents, the school community, we'll put this back up Friday if you have the votes. I don't think you do now, but I thought we might get our first no votes on this committee, but we're not, because there's too many of them to actually. Yes, sir.
Good morning. Actually, I'm here to testify on something else, but being the only person in the room that actually issues gift cards and has several DSL leases, my name is Dan Yates. I'm operator of the Portland Spirit Dinner Boats. To clarify a few issues, one, a 25% retainer is not pure profit. To give you an idea, we instituted gift cards because one of the consumers demanding it. They don't like gift certificates. But the initial cost just for us to get a supply of them is over $25,000. Software upgrades, training, but the actual gift cards themselves cost about 40 cents a piece. Then you have to load the gift cards with whatever value people want, which is A transaction fee every time they load is about 35 cents. It varies between what agreement you're on. And then you get charged a 3.5% fee on top of that because they usually buy it with a credit card. So this wonderful idea that it's pure profit is actually just hogwash. There is genuine cost associated with issuing a gift card. And that doesn't count the fact that every gift card we give out another 60-cent four-color holder that goes into for part of the presentation. So we're well into a dollar on each gift card. So there is a genuine cost associated to the merchant providing this. Just want to clarify that because I know that the state has different... I know DSL very well. I have had more interesting contracts with them. They're not exactly what you would say the most organized division in the state. But that's this is a little different part of it, which is the revenue collecting side. Other issues on gift cards. What do you do when someone comes in and they buy a gift card for a couple hundred dollars? The gift cards are designed to be recharged. So they use $75 up in the first year. And they go, well, I think we're going to recharge it again for another $100. And so they continually, ideally, this is part of the idea of the gift card, is that over the course of several years, they've used some, not used some. At the end of 3 years, what do? As a merchant, I have a balance due on it. They've used it a couple of times. They've recharged it a couple of times. They've gone back and forth. Am I supposed to report that as unclaimed property to the state? I think that there's a reason why 22 states have exempted them, because gift cards are a very interesting and unique beast. They actually represent the electronic age that we're in, and people are treating them like cash. They love the convenience of them. They love the idea of carrying them around, but it's not something that is simply, if it's not being used for a year, it's because it's been put in a drawer, but they do find them. And I'll tell you another thing, as merchants will honor, we've decided we're honoring gift certificates that are 7, 8 years old that we've issued, because we've always treated them as cash. We don't give cash back on them, but we are there in the customer service business, and you put us in a very difficult position. To get a customer is very expensive. To keep a customer is a lot cheaper. But there are a lot of people out there that run a lot of scams. And I'll tell you right now, we sell out. We'll have people come and book and buy gift cards and then turn around and try and finagle cash back on them and try to beat the computer systems. And I guarantee you, you will have people, if you do this 3 year and we are required to report a gift card that's 3 years old, that at 3 years and 2 days, you'll have people coming in saying, oh, here's my gift card for $250. I want to book some cruises. We're in a tight position because we've already reported to the state, and we have to go through the state processes of trying to reclaim that money, I think, but it's not ours. It's in someone else's name under someone else's account. They can turn around and issue the same claim and get the money, and there needs to be some sort of protection to stop that sort of activity, because merchants are going to honor it. I mean, we are no choice. You're in a very difficult position. I mean, we honor lost gift cards, because that is one of the other nice benefits about them being electronic. The last issue I'd like to point out is that it is not possible without significant investment for a company like ours to go and issue a charitable one and a non-charitable one. The person who testified that it's not a big deal is insane, to put it bluntly, because it is a $20,000 investment to buy these cards. They're under a system that they're all pre-printed with numbers. And to say, well, we're going to take this batch over here and say this is charitable and this one's not charitable, is not possible. You're going to have to buy a second batch of cards, and you're going to have to set up a second system. And I probably would cost me in the area of $5,000 to $10,000 just to separate that out. And quite frankly, it's going to be much easier to not do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we went and set up and did the gift cards because we knew from the gift certificate legislation in this state they were treated the same. And we researched this. We're medium-sized business in the state. We sell a lot of gift certificates to Vancouver, and I'm not quite sure how those would figure into this proposal. But the reality is that we had kind of a contract. We put the research in to find out how you all treated this.
Mm-hmm.
And I authorized the investment to do that, and we've had them for about 7 months now. And I just walk in here to talk about something else to find out that you all are now going to change the rules or considering changing the rules.
Well, Mr. Yates, that's exactly right. We're considering changing them.
Right.
And just as in you make decisions, a group of citizens come with this legislation, and we consider that. They come and they say that there's $14 million just in face value just from this last holiday season that went unclaimed, and so they ask us to join the majority of states. The good news for you is I'm not sure we're actually going to join the majority of states, but they say we're part of those consumer group that are concerned about, just out of this last holiday season, $14 million of unclaimed property that will never get reclaimed. And on behalf of, and I'm just giving you their point of view, is on behalf of those consumers, they'd like to see the money in the Common School Fund rather than just simply go unclaimed property. And so that's the decision we have before us. The good news from your point of view is that I think your side might be the prevailing side on this, but that is the case, and that's what we sit here and try to adjudicate.
I will let you also know that I know that that people think that the money will then get transferred over and the interest drawn on it will help schools. Unclaimed property companies or unclaimed gift certificates, when we finally determine in-house we have a certain percentage of them, what happens to them, which might be of interest to you all, is that it is then declared income.
That's right.
And last time I checked, you all have a vested interest in income, which is at 10%, which if you can get 10% interest on the school fund, then you better go do that. Right, then tell me, and I'll put my money in there, too. But right now, you're getting an immediate 10% in income to the state treasury.
Mr. Chairman.
So, on a financial sense, it makes much more sense for you all to allow the unclaimed property to stay with the businesses, and when the businesses finally say, because we have to pay, there's a cost of holding that liability on our books, and it's when it comes to, I have a maximum debt ceiling that I'm allowed to carry with my bank, and so I am always looking for ways to reduce my liabilities, but that's a liability that as soon as I declare it, income, I have to pay taxes on it. And that's where you all directly benefit from it. Much higher rate of return than putting it out for maybe 2 or 3% in the general market for interest on the school fund.
Mm-hmm.
Through
and Senator, well, thank you, Mr.
Okay.
Yates. And just the only, just because I have to say it, it's not we all that benefit from the taxes that come into the state. And in many ways, we've kind of.
We as all of us.
Appreciate that.
No, I understand. I pay my taxes.
And we have an amnesty program for you. Aaron George.
And what's the phone number for the amnesty program?
I want to thank him so much for bringing this issue up, because ever since we started this, I'm sitting there thinking, eventually you're going to have to declare it on the income side, and we're going to hit you with taxes.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's a major issue that has not been brought up before the committee. And it's, you know, I was going to ask that question if he hadn't said it. So thank you very much.
It's a very complex problem that is, well, it's interesting. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michelle. It's always helpful to hear from a real-life citizen on this. So we're going to, not surprisingly,
I didn't schedule it, so I just posted it for 10 o'clock.
And we may not need that, but we'll keep it alive just in case. So to the folks who would like to see this bill move forward, if they could talk to at least three people on the committee and see if...
Carry it over to Friday.
We are going to carry it over to Friday.
I just want to
just make Julie's life interesting if she's there. She is. Close the work session on Senate Bill 845, and last bill of the day. We'll open a work session. I'm not sure if this bill's ready to be worked, but let's open a work session because we have it on for 8:99.
Yes.
896. Open a work session. Anyone here who wants to talk about 896? It's an idea that I've been kind of interested in, but I haven't seen enough evidence that this one's ready to move. don't have a quorum, don't, so.
Yeah, you do have dash one amendments, but.
We'll give you your thoughts, and that's about it.
So I'm just going to close the work session. If the proponents of this are really interested in it, then come make the case before the committee sometime Friday. Close that work session, adjourn the committee.
Can I call some?